I am AC2GS, and my name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. It's been going strong for more than 43 and a half years. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we all sit in front of our radios and exchange ideas and information. We try to learn from each other. We try to teach each other. We try to entertain each other. And I'm glad that you've all returned this Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do it all over again. Let me drop for a moment, and then I will return and give you the usual links. Okay, if you want to reach me via email, that would be either for what we used to call mailbag questions. If you can't reach us on the radio, you can email me the questions. We can discuss it, and you can listen it to it different ways. Or if you have a topic for discussion that you would like to present or be part of a presentation or to listen to. Or if you have a technical puzzle that's interesting, I'm always looking for tech puzzles. Or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder, WS2N, and ask him a space or NASA-related story, you can email him directly. He has an email address at spacenetreport@gmail.com. My email address, so you can try two of them. One is mailbag@ac2gs.com. The other is roy@limarktech.net. We also have a link page for interesting articles that I've picked up during the week. Those are available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, so you don't have to look at it right now. You can look at it next Wednesday. You can get there by typing into your browser either roy.ac2gs.com or the alternative is links.limarktech.net. We have a chat room. It's been quiet for a while, but you never know. If you want to get onto the chat room, you can either type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com or the alternative is chat.limarktech.net. And as I mentioned earlier, we do stream these technical nets. I basically stream the Glen Oaks repeater 24/7. You can pick it up on your browser by typing into your browser technet.ac2gs.com or stream.limarktech.net. And I always like to remind people, MikeKC2NJI has a great archive site. He has archived episodes of the Limark Technical Net that go as far back as September of 2006. His site is called amateurradio.tv. He has over a million visitors, making a million and one. So those are the usual links. Let me drop for a second, and I will be right back.
US2N, chat is down for now for some reason. It says Chatsy is down.
Oh, okay. It was down for me earlier. It popped back up, so I would suggest if people are interested, they could try refreshing the page a few times. It has not had a good time the last month or two. It sends up a lot of error statements. I don't know what their financial status is, but it doesn't bode well for their future, but maybe we should look into alternative chat room technologies.
Copy that. Sounds good. WS2N.
Very good. Well, as per usual, we will be asking for questions of a technical nature, either questions or comments or suggestions or what have you. I was hoping that John, KC2SHO, out of Los Alamos, would have the opportunity to get on the repeater. He remotes. So that we could discuss this very interesting technology that he listened to a presentation on at Los Alamos. They have this thing they call Light Slinger, which can give you a mild headache at first, but ultimately I was able to wrap my brain around it. So it's a fascinating technology unrelated to any antenna that I assume you or I have ever heard of. So I don't know, maybe John will join us a little bit later into the technical net, or someone else will bring it up. We'll see what happens. But nevertheless, we'll ask for questions, and hopefully the first few questions will be amateur radio related. And that should take us to about 10:15. At 10:15, Paul, WS2N, will present the SpaceNet report. till about 11 o'clock p.m., and I will return to tie a bow on it and wish you well. So that's the plan if the laws of physics continue to work and the things continue, I'm able to figure workarounds for things that don't work. So with all that in mind, and I hope the gods of propagation look kindly upon us and you don't lose my signal here from Little Brooklyn. Anyway, this is AC2GS. This is the Limark Technical Net. If anyone has any questions for tonight, especially if they're amateur radio related, please hit that push to talk. Give me your first name and your call sign.
K0BB, Ryan, kilowatts, Bravo Bravo.
And to exchange after everybody.
W2BZ, ham radio related.
WB2CDS, check in only.
Okay, Ryan recognized, Rich recognized, Wes recognized, and W2BTS for the check-in. Anyone else want to put their name down on the list for tonight for any questions or comments?
Correction, it's Whiskey Bravo 2 for Max Delta Sierra.
Okay, very good. Sorry about that.
W2WAL.
Yes, do you have a question for tonight, or are you just checking in?
Whiskey Alpha Lima checking in.
Okay, thank you. We don't really require check-ins. It's just primarily for people who have questions or topics or comments for tonight, but I appreciate your presence. Anyone else want to go on the list for questions or topics for tonight? Okay, perhaps later on. Ryan, you're up first. What's your question or your comment for tonight?
Hey, can I start with a radio check? This is Kilowatt Zero, Bravo, Bravo.
Yeah, this is the TechNet.
Great, thank you. I'm portable. So I'm building an electronics workbench. I've been doing a lot of soldering projects and electronics projects. I have a bunch of them planned. And I was thinking about getting an oscilloscope, and I wanted to know, as a ham radio operator doing building ham equipment and antennas and stuff, is there anything I can use an oscilloscope for? K0BB.
Okay, well, it sort of depends, but the short form answer is yes. It's more a requirement if you're doing technical stuff on it, if you're calibrating it and working to fix equipment. Good old Andy, W2CDL, WA2CDL, had numerous oscilloscopes, and matter of fact, one of his pride and joy about 8-9 months before he passed away, he bought a really expensive oscilloscope that, not only the price of the oscilloscope goes up for the resolution, for the bandwidth, the higher the bandwidth into the gigahertz, and in really deluxe models are able to decode digital binary signals in different protocols. So although it helps you in calibrating, adjusting equipment, fixing equipment, the day-to-day process of being a ham, oscilloscopes don't really factor into it too much. I'm curious, people out there, do you have any good oscilloscope stories? I personally haven't bought one yet. About a year or so, Ed, WB2EAV, bought a very nice Chinese oscilloscopes. They're going down in price. American oscilloscopes have probably the best specs, but they also have the highest prices. German ones as well, Rodenschwartz, what have you. But they're making some relatively very nice and price-conscious models in China.
Great,
I don't understand. What do you mean by good oscilloscope? I've heard the opinion from John, KC2WGB. There is no good oscilloscope. Every oscilloscope is good for its application.
There are more expensive and less expensive oscilloscopes. There are more featured full oscilloscopes. So there's no ultimate oscilloscope, but there are better or worse. And true, it's sort of depending upon how you want to use an oscilloscope. If you want to use an oscilloscope on HF frequencies, you don't need a gigahertz bandwidth oscilloscope. It's wasting money. But just as the general category of oscilloscope, you know, why is one oscilloscope $500 and another one is $20,000 isn't because this company can just fool you into spending $20,000. They offer you a particular design that has more functionality. You may not need the functionality, but for those people that do, it's available at a premium. Matter of fact, Chinese oscilloscopes are kind of weird in one particular way, from my understanding. Sometimes they will build in a lot more functionality into the actual electronics, and then they will lock it down so that you have to pay them money to unlock features of the same piece of hardware. I think for the most part, especially since early oscilloscopes didn't have sophisticated CPUs and such, you know, they built it the way you were supposed to use it. There was no authorization code to unlock things back in the good old days.
This is K2VCV. Gene?
Yes?
Yeah, I've been in electronics all my life, and I think a very, very good oscilloscope is the Tektronix 485 series. They have a 475, 485, but you can't beat a 485, which you probably get on eBay for a couple hundred dollars, and you can always find parts. The other choice would be a LaCroix, which is a digital-type oscilloscope, which is excellent. In fact, it has its own little printer and everything else. You can print out whatever's on the display. This is Gene, K2VCV. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Gene. Yeah, there's a lot of very well-designed older equipment. They're a little bit bigger. They're a little bit heavier, but a lot of them are built like tanks, so that's an option, too. Would you like to offer to Ryan ways that an oscilloscope makes an amateur radio operator's life easier, different things that you could do with it in this hobby?
I used to build stuff like crazy, and I used to use the oscilloscope to check oscillators and whatever, but you can also check, like, if you're on 80 meters AM or sideband or whatever, you could also see the, you know, the frequency. You can measure the frequency and also see the, like, amplitude modulation, the percentage of modulation. You could troubleshoot different stages with the different gains of the amplifiers. You know, there's numerous things. In fact, you could sweep, which I've done many, many times, sweep filters using an oscilloscope. And, you know, the oscilloscope will be the display using the X and the Y, you know, inputs to the oscilloscope. There's quite a few things you could do. I would recommend to go to the ARRL Hints and Kinks, and maybe you could see something, circuits or whatever, that, you know, that are designed to troubleshoot different things, whatever. You could also use it as a like a little curve tracer. They have little circuits which you can actually troubleshoot, you know, transistors or diodes or whatever, solid-state devices using the oscilloscope. They're a very, very handy tool, and you can go like eBay and find something that's very, very good. Go ahead.
AC2GS. So thank you, Gene. Yeah, I mean, a lot of the times when I think of oscilloscopes, I think of them as test equipment and such. But I will give you one thing, and I'd like your opinion. You can figure out the linearity of your linear amplifier. You can tap the signal from the driver and tap the signal from the linear output and create a trapezoidal pattern. And by the linear nature of the trapezoid, you can tell whether your amplification is going on in a linear fashion or a decidedly nonlinear fashion. So that's a good thing to use, not even just calibrating the equipment or building the equipment, but seeing how well it's operating under its specs.
Very good, Roy. I want to make one point very, very clear. You have to make sure you get the right probe for the frequency range and also the voltage. You don't want to, you can very easily damage an oscilloscope with the input amplifiers if you come in with the higher voltage that's, raised. So you usually get a times 10 or even I have a times 100 probe to do various tests. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's very important you get the right probe for the right job. And some of these probes are rather surprisingly expensive. You know, I'm unfortunately or fortunately used to more like volt ohmmeter probes, and they're in a completely different class. But yeah, there are attenuation coefficients for different designs of these probes. And of course, I kind of alluded earlier to probes as well as oscilloscopes are specced for bandwidth. If you're going to operate outside of the band, both for the either for the probe or for the oscilloscope, you're going to get erroneous numbers. So there's a lot of things as I hope you see, Ryan, that you can do. A lot of it is more related to repair or building than maintenance. So, but there is things like the trapezoid pattern. That's a method of indicating how your equipment is operating while it's operating.
Yeah, it's very cool. Thank you. Let me get a radio check again.
Speedwest 2N.
Yes, Paul.
I think it's also a good tool if you're just starting out as a learning tool. You know, I have a Heath kit from decades and decades ago, and I still have it. And it's amazing what you can play around with, you know, like you were saying before, transistors or, you know, just testing things. You know, so it's a great learning tool. But no, I don't have a modern one. You know, the frequencies on this old thing don't go up high enough for, I guess, for UHF or, you know, something like that. Very good for HF. Anyway, back to you.
Yeah, well, they make all different kinds. I don't have one. It's one of the things I haven't quite gotten around to yet. I talked to Ed when he bought his. Probably being an old catcher, I would demonstrate Lissajou figures. Because I was so affected by Outer Limits as a child. And, they had that beginning that we control the horizontal, we control what you see, and they showed an oscilloscope doing a series of Lissajou curves. So that's probably something that I would play with on an oscilloscope if I buy one.
K0BB.
Yes, Ryan.
Yeah, I was going to say this is great. I really appreciate it. I mean, I plan on building some transceivers and getting old. I think it's best that it's all working and then also, you know, be able to see how I built it. It also works. But I was going to say there's two oscilloscope stories I have. One is that I did buy an oscilloscope, but I bought a USB oscilloscope, which is $30. So we'll see how it goes. I don't know, the specs or anything. I don't know much about it, but I'll let you know how it turns out. The other thing is you can make images on an oscilloscope. I think it works best on an old cathode ray tube oscilloscope, but they have sort of waveforms that turn into, like, animations of, like, mushrooms and all sorts of things. You might check it out on YouTube, K0BB.
Yeah, Ryan, back when we old-timers were younger, most game arcades used something called vector graphics, rather than raster graphics, which are pixelated, ones and zeros. Instead, it would apply a voltage potential to the XY coordinates of a cathode ray tube, and because they used long persistence phosphors, there was a residual image, and you could draw all kinds of complex vector-based, so Space Invaders and others like that started originally as vector graphics on cathode ray tube game arcades.
VDH with a comment?
Yes, certainly.
I remember a lot of the older scopes. I haven't seen it on the newer scopes, but a lot of the older scopes had something called Z-axis input, which was intensity modulation, where if you set up the sweep frequencies right and put some vertical sweep in it, you could actually feed video into the Z-axis input and actually get a regular, you know, a picture, an NTSC video picture on the screen, where Z-axis was varying the intensity of the electron stream. Good.
Oh, that's interesting. It must have had a really bad refresh rate. You know, it was probably something like 2 frames a second at best.
Yeah, well, it was acting just like a regular CRT in a TV, because the Z-axis input, I think it went into the grid of the CRT and actually varied the intensity of the electron stream. So if you were sweeping it at the right rates and everything, it was just like a regular picture on a regular NTSC video CRT.
Oh, okay. I mean, my experience looking at old oscilloscopes, they usually used long residual phosphors, so it would kind of get in trouble with the next scan. So that's why, you know, television phosphors are different usually than old oscilloscope phosphors. With television, you wanted a short duration, phosphor emission. With oscilloscopes, because you were going to try and track the same type of a pattern, they preferred it to be a somewhat longer duration phosphor.
I think the P1 phosphor, which was the old green one, you don't see that anymore, but I think the P1 phosphor had the same persistence as the black and white P4 phosphor. So as far as the persistence, I think it pretty much was the same. Of course, the color, I'm only talking, monochrome. But I think the persistence of the P1 phosphor and the P4 was the same.
Okay, I don't have any specs offhand. I just made the assumption based on a lot of videos of people using it that it seemed to kind of give an afterglow that that wasn't visible on my TV sets. I didn't have that much in-person experience with oscilloscopes growing up, but I had a lot of experience with cathode ray tubes in televisions. And I don't know. I always had the sense that the duration was much snappier because, you know, NTSC signals, you had to refresh it 30 times a second. It interlaced.
Well, this is going back way. I remember my first oscilloscope years and years ago that I got down on Cortland Street. It was an old Dumont scope, so you know how old that was. And the sweep circuit in it was a thyrotron. I think it was an 884 thyrotron sweep in it. This was an ancient oscilloscope. This was really going way back.
Yeah, very good. Paul, you wanted to say something?
Mine, you know, I have the cathode ray tube. You get that green, it's a green dot, and then they don't recommend just leaving it there. You know, just put something on. Have a sweep going. They just don't want you to do that. Otherwise, you will wind up with a permanent spot there. And you do see, if you have the intensity up too high, you can cut back on that. If it's too high and you're doing, let's say, a sine wave, you would see a slight after let's call it an afterglow. But if you cut back on the gain on it, you know, then you don't get it. So, you know, if you just keep it a little on, you know, less bright, you really have no problem. But I recommend getting a, you know, an old one just for learning. But if you're going to use one for practical use, you know, something, you know, for modern use, then of course you really have to go for something better. But back to you, Roy.
Yeah, they call that burn-in. What's happening is you're using an electron gun to fire actual free electrons at a phosphor plate, and when the electrons hit it, it excites it and glows and it gives off light. If you have it stay there too long, the phosphors will overheat, they'll burn, and it'll leave a permanent mark. Matter of fact, very, very early computer CRT terminals, I used to use those green phosphors for some reason, because I distinctly remember that those little characters that came out of the CRTs were all green. For a short period of time, some manufacturer tried to promote and sell amber-colored phosphor pigments for the CRTs, and things have gotten a lot nicer and better than that. But the very, very earliest cathode ray tube monitors for computers that I'm aware of all had that kind of ghostly green coloration. Yeah, unfortunately, two people doubled. I never quite know how to deal with doubling where I can't ID either. So try again.
This is Gene, KQCB. I just want to make a comment. Go ahead.
Sure, Gene.
If you go to YouTube, W2AEW, this fella Alan, I believe he works for Tektronix. He has a whole series on that. In fact, what he did was he made an oscilloscope into a little TV, and he used the Z-axis for the intensity modulation. So it's quite a thing to see. He has a whole list of different projects and everything else. Very, very interesting. You go to YouTube on the computer and type in W2AEW. I believe his name is Alan, and he's over. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm familiar with him. He works at Tektronix. He uses a lot of their equipment, obviously. And I saw similar types of things back in the old days. They were slow scan television to get around the bandwidth problems. And I always kind of thought that that's what an oscilloscope TV would sort of look like. So I have to check out. He has so many YouTubes. You can spend the better part of a year probably going through every single one of his YouTubes, which probably is very useful. He's a smart guy, and he does, you know, they're not glitzy, which I appreciate. They're very homey type of presentations, but they're excellent ones. So certainly check out the W2EAW. You just use that as a search criteria on YouTube. So that's a good recommendation, Gene. Thank you.
K0BD.
I don't know if you got the call sign corrected. W2AEW, I believe. I think you said W2EAW. I'm not sure. Go ahead.
I don't think so. I wrote down W2AEW, and like I said, I've probably seen a couple of dozen of his YouTubes.
Yeah, very good, Roy. Yeah, he's got quite a few, and it's not only about oscilloscopes, it's everything else. Boy, I tell you, he really goes to town. And in fact, you can do a lot of measurements and everything else. I think he does the antenna measurements. Shows you how to sweep different things, the whole nine yards. But you're right, it would take quite a long time to go through everything that he has. But an excellent presentation. Go ahead.
Yes, indeed, we both agree. He's a smart guy, and he's able to present what he knows. Unfortunately, there are people out there, and they will continue to go nameless, who understand everything, but when they have to explain it to people, there sometimes is a problem. But he knows a lot of things, and he knows how to explain it to people. So once again, W2AEW, look it up on YouTube, and you can't go wrong. You know, just take a random YouTube video of his, and it'll be fascinating. Ryan, you wanted to make a comment again?
I did. I just wanted to say that I had a second question, but I'll put myself in the back of the queue for it. Thank you. K0BB.
Okay, I'll put you. It's not a very long queue. It's you and Rich because Wesley is going to be talking about non-amateur rated related questions. But I will put you on the list after Rich. Okay.
Copy, K0BB, back to next.
Okie doke. Once again, this is AC2GS. If anyone has any amateur-related questions and wants their name on our very short list tonight, please hit that push to talk.
AC2PO.
Okay, Jeff, I have you down. Okay, let's get back to our list, which now is Rich W2BZ. What's your question or your comment for tonight, Rich?
Yeah, I wonder, what is the definition of an efficient antenna? And why can't all antennas be made efficient? That's it, Roy.
Okay, well, it's kind of simple. It's power in versus power out in terms of radio waves. If you're able to convert all of your electrical power feeding your antenna, turning it into radio waves, it's 100% efficient, and you've probably violated the laws of physics. Everything has some degree of loss. Of thermal resistance rather than radiation resistance, which converts some of the energy of the current going into the antenna into thermal waste heat. So everything is less than 100% efficient. One would like to have the most efficient antenna, but other factors affect the efficiency. The magnetic loop that you know and love is wonderful for many different reasons, but one reason that isn't good at all is that because it has such a low radiation resistance, the amount of efficiency due to insertion loss problems is humongous. So it's a very inefficient antenna, but it's capable of doing a lot of things that other antennas can't, and so people use it despite the inefficiencies. Better to have an antenna that works sort of than no antenna at all. The reason why people will put up these ham sticks on cars with big, massive loaded coils, where in some cases of 80 or 160 meters, the efficiency can be 1 or 2%. But if you only need 1 or 2%, then the antenna is doing what you want it to do. So I hope that makes it understandable about efficiencies.
Okay, well, that brings up a couple of questions. On my mag loop, I have a new SWR meter that's saying that the mag loop is 75% efficient. That's the number I'm getting back. But if you have an antenna, let's say that is 75% efficient, I guess you're stuck with that, right? There's no way of making an antenna more efficient than it is, than it inherently is. Is that correct?
Okay, not quite sure how that goes, but if you don't change anything about the antenna, I guess yes, but you can change the antenna, and changing the antenna will change the efficiency. As an example, let's say you've decided to have a quarter wave vertical, but you don't want it to be as tall as it would have to be normally, so you want a shortened quarter wave vertical. And you decide to put in a big loading coil, like the ham stick that we were just talking about. What you're effectively doing is you're decreasing the radiation resistance and the insertion losses that are inherent in nature become a much greater factor and dissipate more of your RF-producing energy and leaving you a less efficient antenna. If, on the other hand, you rebuild the antenna, and instead of using a loading coil that decreases the radiation resistance, you choose to use a capacitive hat that will make it resonant at a shorter vertical width size, but will still maintain a decent radiation resistance, you will improve the efficiency. And effectively, you're changing it into a different type of antenna. So I'm not quite sure exactly what you conceive of changes in an antenna that don't add up to a different antenna ultimately.
Yeah, well, that's imagine you get a new shiny antenna, a Yagi from Cushcraft. It comes in a box. You put it together. You put it on a mast, and you get the efficiency reading for that antenna. There's no way to make that antenna more efficient, is there? I mean, other than, like you say, other than using that and designing a different antenna off of that basic antenna. You see what I mean? Once you get a Cushcraft antenna, I mean, you're stuck with whatever efficiency rating it has. That's what I'm asking.
Okay. For the sake of the question, yeah. Ultimately, if you don't change any aspect of the antenna, the radiation resistance and such, you can effectively change the resultant efficiency because some of the insertion losses happen before the antenna. You could be using really bad connectors that have a higher resistance. You can be using very, very thin, cheap coaxial cable with high attenuation losses, and all those factor into the insertion loss of the low radiation resistant antenna and effectively worsen the efficiency more so. And one thing that you keep on mentioning that I'm a little confused about is there's really no good indicator for efficiency of antennas. There are kind of junky things that sort of calculate stuff, but it's very dubious of the accuracy of anything like that. Ultimately, you have to be able to somehow be able to measure the RF output of the antenna to tell what the efficiency is. And that's kind of difficult to do for most people.
Yeah, I don't know how this there's a, one box that has the letters EFF, and it comes back as around 75%. I don't know, but I would think the EFF means efficiency. So it's not explained in the little manual what it is, but I thought it was efficiency. And then, I thought, well, I don't know how to make an antenna more efficient. As you're saying, if you're not putting capacitive hats on it or more coils or whatever, you're stuck with whatever the design dictates as efficient. So that's what you're saying, I guess. You're saying you could make other things around it, like the coax. You could change the coax, and in turn, that will make the antenna more efficient, but there's nothing really that you can do to the antenna.
WB2EAV.
Yes, Ed.
In my misspent, ignorant life, I've always found talk about antenna efficiency is when you're trying to get something that nature doesn't like to work. Nature likes half-wave dipoles, quarter-wave vertical loop round plane, and when you start changing from that, you have to play games. And then you get into efficiency where you're saying how much of the energy is going into space and how much is going into the ground. Now, a pushcraft, out-of-the-box beam antenna, properly mounted, I have no idea why that isn't virtually 100% efficiency with converting what's coming down the coax out into signals in space, right?
Okay. Again, it's kind of difficult to be able to measure because you'd have to, you know, it's not that difficult to measure the amount of power going out your transmission line. The trick is to integrate across, space, the strength of all the signals and all the directions to get an idea. You know, because we're not using superconductors, there's going to be ohmic thermal resistance involved in any antenna that I'm aware of, and so there is going to be a non-zero loss. Maybe it's 99% efficient. I don't know. Maybe it's 90% efficient. You know, the problem is kind of quibbling over the decimal point type of a thing. If your signal gets through, it gets through, and that's the bottom line. I think if you try and chase the ultimate 100% efficient antenna, not only will you spend a lot of time and a lot of money and probably a lot of liquid nitrogen.
I love that reference.
Okay, but the bottom line is I'm not quite sure, Rich, what that box is that says EFF. What it might be is simply a rough approximation, if it's your magnetic loop controller, that it's basing the amount of capacitance you're using on what the efficiency, because as we've mentioned before, the highest frequency of a loop antenna requires the least amount of capacitance, which gives you the best amount of radiation resistance it's capable of. And as you go to lower and lower frequencies, you have to tune it by increasing the tuning capacitor, which is going to decrease the radiation resistance and decrease the efficiency. It's more of a, I wouldn't even call it the end of an envelope calculation. It's more of a really slightly educated guesswork. So I wouldn't believe any meter that reads efficiencies of antennas, if I were you.
Another fourth antenna is the one that accepts all the power delivered.
Say again?
I think I know what it is.
Yeah, what is it, Ed?
Consider a classic tri-band, three-element, 10, 15, 20-meter beam. The elements are too short for 20 meters, so they use loading coils. And the loading coils do add an efficiency. And I think that's what it referenced to, but it should specify on the individual bands. But where a classic tri-band, the lowest efficiency where you're using the most traps. So maybe they're just saying on 20 meters, you're paying the price of having an antenna that is less than, 5 meters on the side of the boom. And that is reflected as an efficiency in that you are heating up the traps. Just a theory.
Well, yeah, I would sort of agree with you, Ed. I don't think that these are accurate measurements in any way, shape, or form. These are guesswork approximations that maybe some engineers thought up and built into the system. But you have to take it with a couple of 10-pound sacks of salt. It's not a definitive. I would be amazed if something that said 75% efficiency was actually 75% efficiency. It probably is more efficient than when your meter says 50% efficiency. But what the actual efficiency is anyone, including probably the engineer's guess.
I will tell you, if you can find, show me a meter that says antenna efficiency, I would love to see it. Because in two-thirds of a century of playing with electronics, I've never even heard of one.
Okay, apparently Rich W2BZ owns one, so maybe he can take a picture of it and then share it with us.
I will. Maybe they're multiplying or dividing, I don't know, reflected power versus forward power. That's SWR, right? I don't know what they're doing. That's why I brought up the question. I will take a picture of it and send it to you, Roy, and maybe you can post it.
Yeah, I'd love to see this, Roy, because all I'm hearing, it makes no sense to me at all.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. Reflected forward versus reflected power is how you calculate standing wave ratio. It's not how you calculate efficiency, because it's not only the reflected power. Reflected power sometimes can get reflected back into the antenna, and then you're dealing, again, with attenuation losses and other such things. So there's really no great correlation between the efficiency of an antenna and the attenuation loss due to impedance mismatches. I mean, they'll lead to less power, but I don't think anyone would describe it as the efficiency. Efficiency is a special thing. It's defined. It's not just general loss of energy due to anything. So maybe they have it mislabeled. I don't know. I'll take a look at it. I'll see what I can make of it. But there really should not be any meter known to mankind that has efficiency as the meter movement indicator, as Ed mentioned.
Okay, Roy, there was another commenter in there that you didn't pick up right before Ed. He doubled with Ed, so... Maybe that person, can you come back and say what you were saying? Guess not. All right, I will. We'll figure this out. I'll send you a picture and we'll take it from there. Thanks, Doc.
You're welcome, Rich, anytime. You know, I mean, we all kind of prefer more efficient designs. They cost us less, and they heat up less, and all kinds of fun stuff. And so technology is creeping towards better, higher efficiencies as long as the price-performance ratio isn't ridiculous. You know, like I mentioned earlier, I would assume that if you start to use antennas that are made out of superconducting material and then immerse them in liquid helium, they might have better efficiencies. It probably wouldn't cost you more than about $50 or $80 million, you know, on a good day. So I don't know about you, but I don't got that sitting around in the bank. So I'll deal with a 50% efficiency antenna if that's all that I could get. Yes.
If you want to play with liquid helium, I'll tell you where to put it. The receiver front end. Nowhere else. You're wasting your time. What you want to do is lower the thermal noise in your receiver front end. There you get benefit. Deep space communication antennas use cryogenically cooled front ends to lower the noise level below the nominal ambient theoretical. Otherwise, wasting your time.
Well, I would agree with you. My example was making a case in the absurd that theoretically, if you had a room temperature superconducting metal and you used it as the radiating portion of an antenna, you would have some degree of improvement in your efficiency. is what I was alluding to. It's not practical. It's downright silly. And I agree with you. Applying the technology to the front end where noise is a function of absolute temperature, and if you can bring that absolute temperature closer and closer to zero, you can eliminate the thermal noise in the front end where it's most important. So I agree with you.
Oh, by the way, WB2AV. I have a comment about this, hopefully the final comment, but it does involve an absolute terrible plug for HRU. Shall I?
Certainly.
I think you should announce to everybody that the first ham radio university face-to-face in 3 years is going to be on January 6th at GW Post College, Hillwood Recital Center. And I will be presenting a one-hour talk on test equipment for hams, the same presentation the late Andy WA2CDL used to present, and I'm honored to take up his mantle. But I have an idea. I will add an antenna efficiency meter to my talk.
Okay, that'll be interesting to see.
Now all I have to do is make something up between now and January 6th.
Well, I wish you Godspeed with that.
Well, right after the micro VNA, I guess.
Well, you know, when you finish with that, maybe you could work on some room temperature metallic superconductor material.
Nah, others have done that far better than I ever could.
Okay, very well, Ed. You know, it's a shame. I was hoping that John from Los Alamos was going to be available tonight. I don't know if you heard, I think it was last week, he was discussing this presentation that he received at Los Alamos for a brand new antenna technology that Los Alamos has been working on for 15 years, actually, called LightSlinger.
That would be fascinating, but if you do know someone from Los Alamos, I do have a serious, serious question ever since I was there about 12 years ago.
Okay, I mean, John, KC2SHO, comes by at least once or twice a month, so the next time he's around, I'll try and see if you're around and you can ask him that.
Should I tell you what it is? It's not that difficult to explain.
Certainly.
I assume you've seen those World War II pictures that were declassified years after the fact of Fat Man and Little Boy?
Yeah.
They basically look like big bombs, right? It's knowing what was inside that counts, but by themselves they weren't very impressive, correct?
Yeah, they were just big pieces of metal that looked like a bomb.
Well, the Bradbury Museum, no relation to the author Ray Bradbury. There was some head of a lab named Bradbury Museum named after him. They have life-size models of Batman and Little Boy. And when I saw them, my jaw dropped. Each one has a UHF Yagi facing forward on each side. I said, what the hell is that? And then I realized, they've got radar altimeter detonators. I'd like to confirm my theory.
Oh, that's interesting. I don't recall seeing that on the photographs. Maybe we weren't allowed to. I don't know. It's kind of weird that the American weapon that stopped World War II in Japan included antenna technology designed by people in Japan.
It's worse than that. The Japanese army refused to use the Yagi-Uda array.
Ah, geez, military, they act in mysterious ways.
You know, the Japanese sort of listened to Yamamoto before they sent him to attack Pearl Harbor. He said, don't do it. His exact words were, you will awaken a sleeping tiger. And 4 years later, and he was right, 4 years later, Japan was basically bombed back to the Stone Age, and then they dropped the atomic bomb.
Well, there's a lot of chit-chat historically about it. The Japanese, one of their ethnic characteristics is face. They really have a problem being shamed. And so you can't just show the Japanese at war that they're losing and they say, okay, we give up. It's not like a chess match, you know, where if a guy has a bad position and his pieces are gone mostly, and he knows that, you know, he'll survive for 10 more moves, but ultimately he's lost the game, and then they surrender it. The Japanese didn't work that way. So unfortunately, although, you know, what happened is a terrible thing, I don't know exactly what you would have to do to the Japanese to convince them to stop their war. So I don't know. It's tough.
You do realize I owe my very existence to the atomic bomb.
I believe in the back of my mind I recall something like that, but please use this as an opportunity to tell me again because I forgot the details.
My father was absolutely 100% sure his demise would be in a muddy hole in Japan, not in a hospital bed in Brooklyn so many years later.
Yeah, I remember that one. Yeah, I don't know. There's been a lot of people going back and forth and back and forth on the subject of, was it appropriate? Wasn't it appropriate? I am reminded of Truman, who did not have a middle name. He had an initial. It was Harry S. Truman. And someone asked him, Mr. President, what's the S stand for? And he said the S stands for the letter S. So he did not have a middle name. And he had that thing on his desk that the buck stops there. And he made the decision. And everyone who quibbles over it, 50, 60, 70 years later, you know, lots of luck. You might as well have an argument of how many angels can stand on the head of a pin.
All right, I normally try to avoid those, but I have one thing I saw on Channel 13 on a documentary when Hirohito died.
Okay.
According to this documentary, and the documentaries I've seen on Channel 13 have tended to be quite accurate, but I can't prove this. After the two atomic bombs, apparently the Japanese war cabinet was planning on hanging tough when Hirohito, emperor, violated all protocols. He was supposed to have no say in such affairs. He said to them, almost crying, haven't we had enough? And if he hadn't done that, my father would have died in that muddy hole in Japan, and I wouldn't be here.
Well, you know, sometimes it takes one single individual at the right time and the right place to be the pivot point for world history. It's kind of amazing how that happens, and a lot of people discount the individual, but I've never done that, hopefully never will. Wars never particularly a good idea. You know, and the idea that the leaders of the government didn't care what the army thought, I think that's a general thing that happens all over the place. I mean, I think the German army was thought Hitler was crazy, which he was, didn't think they were going to survive his first few battles. And unfortunately, he played chicken with Europe, and up until a point, chicken wins. So it's unfortunate. I hope we never see another world war again.
About your comment about Hitler. Ask Erwin Rommel what he thinks about that.
Well, no one's...